So today is the fourth day in this five-part, five-day introductory course. And we've talked about the basic meditation posture. We've talked about the use, the centrality of mindfulness of breathing as a central kind of focus of the practice. But also about how our bodily experience, our embodied experience, is a very important part of the practice. And last week we talked about emotions and how emotions are incorporated within the mindfulness practice. Before I start today to kind of continue with expanding the instructions, I wanted to take some time to see if there's any questions or anybody who wants to report about how it's been practicing at home or... When? Yeah, it's on. I was mindful. Yes. Any? No. So it's all. Yes.
Something I wasn't clear about was, you know, first you focus on your breathing, and then I wasn't really sure whether you wait to see if an emotion comes up and then attend to it, or whether you have an intention of looking to go, oh, okay, let me check in and see, am I having some emotions? Is there something happening in my body, or is it more just sort of go wherever everything goes?
Yeah, it's more like going with whatever appears. So one image of the meditation, this kind of meditation practice, would be this is a traditional imagery that sometimes the human body, human being, is depicted in some Buddhist art as being a one-room house with a door and four windows representing the five sense doors. And so you can imagine that in the middle of this one-room house, there's this most wonderful and most comfortable easy chair. And that you're sitting there quite relaxed, and nothing needs to happen, nothing needs to occur. And you're sitting there kind of relaxing in this easy chair. And you become aware of what comes through the window or the door. You don't go out looking for things, but you're just kind of sitting there contently, and oh, there comes a bird at that window. Oh, here comes a friend coming through that door. Oh, here comes a terrible wind coming through that window. Oh, isn't that interesting? You're kind of sitting there interested in what appears at the different doors. But you never kind of leave your ease in your easy chair. So we usually don't sit in an easy chair when we meditate. We take kind of an upright, balanced, aligned posture. But the kind of attitude of the mind is to be at ease in that way, like you would be at an easy chair. And then we let our attention go to first receive the breath. And just the kind of choice we make, we just kind of choose to stay with the breathing. And use the breath as a way to cultivate and encourage us to stay in the present. Because the breath is always in the present, and it's always in our body. So it's a way of being in the body, and it's being in the present moment. So we're training ourselves to be more and more in the present by being with the breath. And when the mind wanders off into thoughts in the future, the past, or whatever, we just come back to the present with the breath here. When something else arises through one of the sense doors, something else comes through the window that's quite large, if an elephant comes through the front door, you should recognize the elephant is there and forget about the breath. And if a giraffe comes in through the, puts his head through the other window, say, oh, a giraffe. It isn't like you're looking for anything. You're just, oh, look at that. So as you're sitting here and you're following the breath, if a strong physical sensation arises in the body, feelings in the back or the knee, or tension, or feelings of great warmth and pleasure in the body, whatever it might be, if it's quite predominant, so it's really strong, it's kind of compelling in its own right, so it's difficult to stay with the breathing, then just let go of the breath. No need to struggle with the breath. Let go of the breath and attend to what has appeared in the body. And then if an emotion is what is compelling, has arisen, and you feel kind of a struggle between being with the breath or being with the emotion, then just let go of the breath and be with the emotion. But feeling the emotion in the body. We try to, in this practice, it's so useful, once you've acknowledged what's there and you're there present for it, to turn yourself into the bodily experience of that particular event. So an emotion will often have a bodily element to it. And that's a way of acknowledging the emotion without getting caught in the continuing to fuel the emotion through our thinking and our thoughts. Does that clarify a little bit? So you're quite at ease. The practice is one of great ease. It's not like you don't have to memorize all of this and try to, well, is it the emotion in the body, and you know, investigate and do this and all that. It's more like, oh, this is what's going on. So we're learning to recognize what's going on. We're learning to go out and find things. We're learning how to recognize what's actually appearing for us. And everything's included. The beauty of mindfulness practice is that the whole realm of human experience is included. And the great gift that we have is the gift of awareness, of being conscious. And what we're trying to learn is how to let this gift be really shine all around. It said, it's one of the expressions, be all, shining all around. I think so it includes everything. And one of the things, one of the beauties about this gift of awareness is that the more aware we are of our experience, the greater is a realm of choice we have. And the more choice we have, the more freedom we have. If you're not aware that you're angry, you probably don't see you have a choice about whether to get angry or not. But if you see your anger, if you see the hurt that precedes the anger, then you can see there's a choice at the hurt, what to do with it, whether to get angry or whether to, you know, do something else. So the awareness, the stronger the awareness, the greater the choice we have for our life and how we choose to do things, and more freedom arises. Long answer. Yes.
Is duration important?
Duration.
Yeah. The longer you meditate, the better.
Oh, if the longer you sat and meditated, if sitting a long time was important, then chickens would be Buddhas. What's important is the quality of the attention, the quality that you're really bringing your attention to the present moment. And sincerely, completely. And if you're concerned about getting somewhere, if in the moment of doing the practice, if you're concerned about what you're going to attain in 5 minutes or in 2 years or whatever, in that moment, that anticipation and expectation gets in the way of being fully present. So in the moment, the idea of duration doesn't matter. However, it is also very helpful to sit for some length of time. If you only sat for 5 minutes each day, probably you wouldn't settle as deeply and develop the practice as well as you would if you sat for 45 minutes. So I think, you know, half an hour to an hour is a good length of time to sit. But some people don't have time for that and they sit for 20 minutes each day. Some people go overboard and they start sitting 5-6 hours a day. And sometimes that's useful. And sometimes it can be a symptom of an attachment, of an addiction or escapism sometimes. So it's a little bit complicated, the issue of duration. Sometimes we do retreats where we sit all day, for example, or we sit all day for 10 days or all day for 3 months. So that's a lot of duration. And that's found to be very useful at times, but we should have some sense, some wisdom about how we're doing it, so we don't just doing it rotely like a chicken. What's important is really the quality of the attention more than the length of time. Yes?
I've heard stories of people who sit for days at a time, apparently without moving or anything.
Yes, it's possible.
Really?
It's not really, they're not doing mindfulness practice, they're doing a concentration practice. But if your concentration gets very strong, it's possible, and various other conditions have to happen, it's possible to enter into a kind of a somewhat not a, I don't know if dormant is the right, hibernating, or I don't know if that's the right word, but kind of a suspended state. It's possible to go many days without eating, or going to the bathroom, or drinking, or, you know, all these things. You're just sitting there in deep meditation, absorbed, and you know, the person doesn't move. I don't know much about this. Some of the Buddhist texts claim that the maximum length of time you can do this is 7 days and seven nights. That somehow something happens that makes it difficult or impossible to do it longer than that. But you meet people who, especially in Southeast Asia, who've cultivated this ability. And I remember hearing stories when I was in Thailand of these teenage novices, like they're 13 years old, had developed this ability for 24 hours. For 24 hours, they can just be in this absorption, and you know, there's no pain, there's no need for anything, no drinking, no eating, no nothing. And so they came to Bangkok to the headquarters to get some kind of certificate they could do this. And these three boys, and only two of them succeeded because one of them got a little bit too excited about being in Bangkok to pull it off. So it's possible, but generally it doesn't have much value, and it's not something which generally in Buddhist circles we try to cultivate or emphasize. Certainly not in mindfulness. It has its place. Everything has its place, but it's... So everything's going fine. No one's having difficulties. Was it useful, the instructions last week on emotions? Is it helpful or confusing? Okay. Everything's going fine. We're all sitting here in our easy chairs.
Well, it wasn't so fine for me. I actually missed last week. And I found that my commitment seems to be wavering. It was quite strong, you know, the first couple of weeks, and it's not quite as engaged as it was. Do you have any thoughts or ways to, on those days or a couple of day stretches when your attention's not there or it's hard to be mindful?
Well, those days happen to everyone. And if it's possible, it's very useful to develop some discipline. Regardless of how you're feeling about it, regardless of your motivation or lack of motivation, your enthusiasm or lack of it, no matter what, you're going to sit every day. And just you do it matter-of-factly. And after a while, it's like, you know, if you haven't run for a while and you start running, the first, you know, 100 yards or whatever it's long, it's just god-awful. You know, it's the same thing with meditation. You need a certain kind of, you know, it can be a certain kind of resistance in the beginning or various times. And just having a commitment that just busts through that can be very useful. What's perhaps more profound to say is that I think it's more important than sitting every day. It's actually more important to check in every day to what your deepest intention is for yourself for that day. What is your heartfelt deepest wish for yourself for that day or for your life? And then if you can find that each day and actually take the time to find that, that's a transformative thing for a person to do in our life, because most of our lives are so busy, we don't check into that, we don't know that. We have all these surface motivations that don't really even connect to that deep motivation, that get in the way or get sidetrack us or whatever. But to really check in every day and find out what that is. And then if there's a connection between your deep intention and a meditation practice, then you might feel it might be easier to want to sit. So you're really coming out of you. And not something externally imposed on top of you. I talked a little bit on Monday night about this, is that a lot of people, when they first come to do a meditation practice, will be very excited by it, and so have a certain amount of beginner's luck sometimes. Partly the excitement and the interest, it's novel, it's new, it's unique, it offers a lot of hope, it has this great ideal, enlightenment, you know, and I'm going to be the first one, and this is, you know, this has hope for me, and you know, or whatever, you know, something. So it's all this excitement at first because it's something special and nice, and it's nice, you know, it kind of keeps you going for a while. But inevitably, the specialness, the wonderful expectation and hope that the that sometimes, you know, ideal hope that it's going to do this wonderful thing for you, begins naturally to dissipate. And actually, it's kind of like a marriage. You know, you fall in love, and after a while, maybe the falling in love kind of changes, and then you have to kind of enter a kind of a whole different kind of relationship with the person. It's different from the kind of passion it was at first. Same thing with the meditation practice. You know, at first there's all this, you know, enthusiasm, and then after a while it gets, you know, kind of ordinary. And if it's ordinary, some people will often stop doing it. But actually, it's much more important to continue when it's ordinary than when it's special. Yes?
The instruction last week was helpful to me, but it seemed like more in my daily life than when I was actually sitting. When I was sitting, it seemed like, now the instruction was to have, or I kind of heard it as notice emotion. Right? So, but when I was sitting, it seemed like I didn't have an emotion. Or, I don't know, I mean, it was just like nothing that was going on internally, but it seemed like in my life, I found myself applying the instruction and noticing when I was having an emotion, then there was all this baggage associated with it, and I was thinking a lot about it, and then separating them.
Uh-huh.
It's almost like meditating.
Great.
They're not so much.
Oh, that's great. No, you don't have to have strong motions when you're sitting. It's no, there's no requirement. They'll come eventually. You don't have to be in a hurry to have them. They'll be there one day. When they'll either be there when there's something strong in your life, or they'll be there when it's appropriate for them to be there. And there's various reasons why some people are more or less in touch with their emotions, or why some emotions. Why there's more stronger emotions for some people than others at times. But in mindfulness practice, you don't have to worry about what's happening in your experience. All you have to do is dedicate yourself to being as attentive as you can, as awake as you can, to what is actually given to you in the moment. Because you're sitting in the easy chair, just taking what comes. That's the idea, right? If no emotions comes knocking at your door, don't worry. If numbness comes knocking at your door, get very interested in it. Study the numbness. But if you're not numb, you're not just, it's fine. Yes?
Could you say a little more about checking in with intention? I find when I try to do that, it very often gets off into thought, discursive thought.
Well, I don't know. It seems that it's easy to do that because intentions have consequences. And so it's easy to kind of have a lot of associated thinking about it pretty quickly. I find it's best to check into my deepest intention after I've sat for a little while. So it's kind of like, which comes first, right? To sit for a little while and get kind of calm. And then so that just out of some calmness and out of kind of more of a silent mind, I'm asking, almost like I'm asking my body or my heart, you know, what's my deepest intention? And allowing something to surface. And it can be a very simple phrase or a very simple, very feeling. And then just leave it at that rather than thinking about what it implies. It's more like listening to the body. That's all I feel like saying now. Last one, and then we'll do the sitting.
Is there a sort of a limit to which one becomes attentive? I mean, I heard what you had to say last week, and I suddenly discovered that there's a whole variety of sort of emotions and things that are going on almost continuously, and upsetting kinds of ones that I notice that I'm upset about lots of things. It seems like all the time. Does that sort of fade away, or does this get to a place where you do this just sort of all the time, and then the other things that one might be doing might sort of fade away?
You mean all the difficult emotions, will they stop after a while?
Yeah.
And you're sitting there in blissful awareness of...
No, I mean, like driving here tonight.
Yeah.
I mean, I become aware...
It's a good question. Various things can happen. One is, that's actually quite profound, but doesn't sound so satisfying perhaps, is that we can learn to have a different relationship to those difficult emotions. And so we're not controlled by them, for example. It's okay to have the uncomfortable feelings, but we're not acting on them, we're just allowing them to be there. And that's a very powerful kind of freedom, just to let them go through us. As we get to know them better, and as we become more sensitive to some of the underlying emotions and kind of the source of them, and as our concentration and mindfulness gets stronger, it's possible to actually transform some of them, or be transformed in deeper ways, so that the feelings of anxiety or the feelings of aversion that motivate, you know, much of a person's life, perhaps, are no longer there. So rather than being anger being a dominant emotion, maybe it's more loving kindness or kindness which becomes more dominant. So it's possible to have that kind of switch with a practice. And the two go hand in hand, because as we don't identify, as we don't get caught up in or preoccupied with the emotions that arise, their force becomes smaller and smaller. And eventually some of them will just fade away. And some of them will just are in the background and like little flies. It reminds me that one of the fun meditations I like to do is driving on the freeway and paying attention to my emotions, the subtle ones. Because I might have a predominant mood, you know, whatever. But what I find is this kaleidoscope of subtle emotions that are constantly shifting as I'm driving. You know, someone pulls up in front of me too close. Oh, anger. You know, and someone drives this, you know, incredibly beautiful car next to me. Oh, desire. A police car kind of appears in the back and a little bit of fear. You know, and there's, you know, actually there's this kaleidoscope of constantly shifting emotions and feelings that go on subtly. And it's really amazing to tune into it. And because they're happening even if we're tuned into them or not. And if we're not tuned into them, one of the consequences can be is that certain ones of them, because they're being repeated over and over again, can build and build and have certain momentum to it. So by the end of the day, we're exhausted. But if we can kind of be there and see the kaleidoscope arise in the past, then they can pass right through us and we're not caught by it. It doesn't stress us. Most stress, in Buddhism, we say that all stress, but maybe we should better say most stress, is self-induced. We usually blame it on the environment, on work, on things, right? But it really has to do with the ways in which we relate to all that, not to it itself. And so that's why one of the very powerful things that mindfulness can teach us is by learning to pay attention to the ways in which we react and respond to conditions around us. We can see actually the genesis of our stress. And if we can see the genesis of our stress, we really see where the responsibility has to be if we want to take responsibility for it. Though sometimes it's good to kind of take 280 instead of 101. Okay, so let's do a little sitting. And if you want to stand for 15 seconds, you may. You know what the numbers are? You know what they are? Any time? Every 5 seconds? Or distance? So take a comfortable, alert posture. And softly close your eyes. And then you can take a couple of deep breaths. And as you breathe in, connect from the inside to your body, as if the expansion is arising from the center of your being and expanding out into your body. And as you breathe out, you're letting go, you're relaxing back into that center point. And then letting your breath breathe itself. See if you can find, if there are any tense muscles in your body from a busy day that might be easy to relax, easy to soften. So that maybe as you breathe out, as you exhale, you softly acknowledge, softly let go or relax the face, the jaw, the eyes, the shoulders, the stomach. And if it doesn't relax, just simply acknowledging the tension with a soft awareness. And then feel, take a few moments to feel your whole body. Whatever way your body happens to be at this moment. Your body, its weight against its seat, against the floor. The torso rising up, upright. Feel your body the way it is right now. And if it makes sense, feel it from the inside. And then within the body, as part of the body, become aware of your breathing. Letting the breath, the exhalations and inhalations, the expansions and contractions, let them become conscious. Like snowflakes, no two breaths are the same. When the mind wanders away in thought, and softly and gently come back to the breathing, feeling the breath, letting the mind be at ease like it's in the easy chair, receiving the breath as it comes in and out through the door. during the exhalation, remembering to let go of the thoughts you're caught up in. Coming back to the breath. So you're fully there for the beginning of the inhalation. as we continue sitting here, I'd like to suggest a little exercise. And that is, continue with the mindfulness practice, paying attention to your breath. But when you find yourself thinking, involved in thought, notice something else besides the content of your thoughts. Notice something else about the thinking besides what you're thinking about. Maybe you can notice the quality of the voice, the way that's speaking the thoughts. With what kind of voice do you speak to yourself? It's soft or harsh, judgmental or accepting. What is the energy level of the kind of thoughts you have? What does your body do? How does your body express your thinking? Kind of explore and investigate this phenomena of thinking, which is so common. We never really study, except often just we study the content, the ideas, the stories. What else can you learn about it if you sit here watching it? And then you can let go of the exercise. And for the last minute of the sitting, devote yourself to being simple with the breath. This simple-minded presence with each breath for a minute. So today we expand the instructions to include our thinking, thoughts. And our thinking and our thoughts are a very important part of our life. And there's sometimes the belief or the idea in meditation circles or among meditators, the point of meditation is to have a thoughtless mind, is to have a mind that doesn't think, you know, be silent. And that's not actually the case, especially not in mindfulness practice. It is if you want to enter one of these seven-day absorptions. but it's not the case in what we do. And it's not really the expectation that the mind is supposed to be completely quiet. What's more important than letting the mind become completely quiet of thought is not to be bothered by your thoughts, not to be caught by your thoughts, not to be controlled by your thoughts. But to have thoughts, the mind naturally produces thoughts, that's what it does. And to be at ease with that and not troubled by it is a very important part of mindfulness practice, meditation practice. But we're often not left alone by them. And it's phenomenal to me how interested we are in our thoughts and how blind we are to them in some sense and how we're caught by them. And thoughts hide... Our preoccupation with thoughts hides thoughts from ourselves. We are distracted by our we're distracted from our distraction by our distraction. If we start paying attention to thoughts, it's phenomenal we learn. One thing is how repetitive they are. How there's so much the same concern over and over again. One form they take is, for many people, is the primary, overwhelmingly, the main form of thoughts they have are self-referential thoughts. Thoughts about that have to do with, has some reference to myself in relationship to everything else. And as I say sometimes, you know, if anybody else went around and spoke to me in my ear, and spoke to me as constantly, as I speak to myself, and spoke to me as repetitively as I speak to myself, I would not only be begging them to stop, I would think they were crazy, and I would be paying them to stop, or, you know, might get even more dramatic. But what amazes me is that we can... have this incessant thinking going on and on and on, and often it's very repetitive. You know, some slight nuances or differences here and there, but and how we continually stay interested. You know, very interested. And whereas if someone was speaking the same thing to us constantly, we wouldn't be so interested. And where does that interest come from? Why are we so captivated by the and so fascinated by our own thoughts? I mean, sometimes we get bored, but I think most of us, most of the time, are captivated. And I suspect that some of it has to do with the fact that so many of the thoughts are self-referential. And we're very interested in ourselves and very interested in how the world impacts on ourselves. And we're somewhat self-centered in ways that get in the way. You know, if you're 99% of the time you're thinking about yourself, then you're not really noticing much else that's going on around you. But thoughts, you know, have their problems, but they're an important part of life, and the point of mindfulness practice is not to stop us from thinking and getting rid of our thoughts, but point of mindfulness practice is to learn how to be awake in the midst of our thinking. Point of mindfulness practice is learn to be awake in whatever is going on for us. To be caught. Allison has been trying to train me for years. And when I hear the click, the tape turns over to pause or repeat what I just said. So what you just saw, what you just witnessed was a successful act in mindfulness. After years of failing. So how to be awake in the midst of our thinking. So how to be awake in the midst of anything. So before I go on, talk a little more about thoughts and the instructions for thoughts, What was it like to do a little exercise at the end of the sitting? What did you, were you able to discover something different about your thinking aside from its content? Yes.
Sometimes it has a number of different qualities. Like sometimes it feels like it's fluttering around, and sometimes it's like a pinball and it's just bouncing off of unrelated topics, and then sometimes it'll just chase something down. So you've got a little jerk of anxiety if I chase something, and it's kind of fun to backtrack to figure out how I got there, because it's junk.
Thank you. No one discovered anything? Well, actually, let me warn you. You guys are kind of a quiet group. To warn you about one of the shadow sides, one of the dangers of Buddhist meditation practice and Buddhist culture, if you hang out in Buddhist circles, is these Buddhists, you know, eventually they don't say much. They kind of, you know, become, you know, Buddha is supposed to be kind of serene and not troubled by anything. And so if you ask a question, it means you're kind of troubled by something. You're not really cool or something. And so you guys are, it looks like you're going in that direction. So I'm warning you about this danger if you continue your involvement with Buddhism. Yes. Go ahead, Stephanie.
I was thinking that while I was meditating with, if you're so in control of, my mind kept asking myself, if you're so in control and you don't spontaneously react to your emotions, do you lose something about your personality? And then you were just saying that you do become very, calmer than.
You don't automatically become, but sometimes people will, in Buddhist circles, I've noticed. I'm not saying always, but. I was kind of a little bit tongue-in-cheek here, but sometimes in Buddhist circles, people will be reticent to speak up, or will be reticent to speak up when there's conflict, for example. And that's a kind of misunderstanding of the practice.
Well, do you become less creative? Because I would.
No, I think you become more creative. The issue of spontaneity is often asked, and I would say that if we spontaneously lash out in anger at someone, I don't think that's really creative spontaneity. Actually, you're probably more likely you're under control of something, and the deeper wellsprings of real creativity don't have a chance. So the being aware of in the present moment, creating space in the present moment, actually allows, more likely to allow a deeper wellsprings of creativity to surface.
Notice that it's I have legions of people back there whispering. It doesn't seem to be a thought so much as like a backdrop of hundreds.
You recognize some of them?
Yeah, I can pull them forth. I play music in the background.
I see.
Music echoing. kind of plan, and that keeps going over. Once I've decided I'm going to do something, I go through that list,
uh-huh.
And that keeps going on. And bits and pieces of what you've said.
There's all kinds of little thoughts can flitter about, and sometimes people will have a sense that they recognize a voice. You know, sometimes it's one of the parents' voice. You know, if the nature of thought sometimes harsh or critical. Oh, who was it who was always that way? You realize maybe it was someone who was very important in your life who you've internalized. Yeah.
Yeah. What I notice is that there's a part of my mind, I guess, that with great conceit, it seems. I mean, as you say, things percolate up that seem sort of unrelated. I wouldn't even call them thoughts. Impressions, images, sort of half thoughts, and there's a part of mind that goes around very concerned about organizing, and it has to take responsibility for anything that happens in your mind, and it has to sort of intellectualize, and so it kind of gathers things that are unrelated and makes them into thoughts, or it's constantly dignifying these things, saying, well, we have to put this in a certain context that the intellect sides and busy sweeping up and organizing, connecting things. It probably
sounds exhausting.
I mean, you can just let them also go by and not do that.
Yes, does sound exhausting the way you described it. And one of the things to actually spend more time, useful as an exercise to explore, is get to know more that organizing tendency. What else is going on? In particular, are there any emotions associated with it? Is it an emotionally neutral event? Or does it have some flavor of emotionality connected to it?
I'd say it's varied, actually.
It varies, yeah. But the emotionality sometimes is a very interesting door to getting into a deeper connection with oneself. And also you might find out that maybe it's not so necessary to always do. Sometimes it might be useful and sometimes not so necessary. It might actually get in the way of some deeper sense of connection with oneself and the flow of images, impressions, and really getting quiet inside oneself.
It's kind of like when your heart goes boom, boom, boom. And that's what your heart does, but your mind will take possession and say, "Oh my God, this is that. What does this mean?"
Yeah, it's
just a
pen. Right. You don't need, and it's not necessary to get caught up in that. Just allow things to be. You can, especially in meditation practice, where we have our opportunity in meditation practice is to really allow things to be as they are without getting involved. And that trains us very powerfully to do the same thing in daily life. Not that we're as quiet, we're not thinking as much, but we have much more patience and allowance in all kinds of activities in daily life, in wise ways. Yes?
I became very irritable, and I've had a couple of really restless meditations. One where I didn't even sit as long as I had planned on sitting, and I was sitting here just feeling like I could explode. And so I'm wondering what happens with all those emotions and feelings if I just sit and just let it stay there and don't really... is it staying in my body? Is it going to come out like a volcano later on? Or,
well, it depends if you're holding it. If it's frozen, it might. The idea with mindfulness is we're feeling it fully, the emotions. And the operating word is feeling, going into the body and feeling the emotion in the body. And really feeling it fully, giving ourselves full permission, radical permission to feel the emotion totally and fully. So there's no ignoring of it, there's no repression of it. But you don't have to act on it either. You don't have to kind of, you know, spill it out. Crying is good. You can cry. You know, just cry if you want. But you don't have to start, you know, beating pillows and stuff like that. That kind of feeling and emotion fully is kind of honoring it also, and it allows it to begin moving through us because it doesn't stay stuck then. It might stay stuck for a while, but as we bring more careful attention to it. It tends to feel it more fully. The more fully we can feel it, the more freer it becomes. And it begins to process and move through us and loosen up. Though as it gets looser, it might get stronger too. But, you know, it has various, you know, permutations that it goes. But it begins to move and find its healing. So restlessness is a great one. You know, be really restless in sitting. It's one of the, you know, great meditations to do as a body meditation. Just sit there and feel the restlessness in your body. Feel the, you know, the legs that want to bolt and the arms that want to kind of explode and the energy coursing around. And you're just dedicated to sitting still with it all. You don't move your body one bit. And you just feel all this excitement like a circus, you know, going on inside. And it creates a kind of healing space for it if you just kind of allow it to move freely within you without acting on it.
I guess what I experienced was the. You had mentioned earlier about the voices and were they from the past or something. The messages that I had, I think, were messages that I'd gotten before. But when you said, listen to the voice, the quality of the voice, it, even though some of the messages might have been negative, the voice was soft and almost nurturing, and it's kind of confusing for me because it seems like maybe I'm reversing my previous tendency to be more aggressive and tough and getting softer, but I haven't mastered the messages that I'm giving myself yet. You know, so it's like two stages.
Maybe.
But it was a thank you for offering that lesson, because it was a great lesson for me to see, you know, where I'm still kind of stuck, I think, and where I can do some more work.
Great, thank you.
I've recognized, not in this particular sitting, but last night, that I think the potency of certain thoughts for me is that I believe in magic. It's like, you know, if I just think these thoughts really hard, it will come true. I can reconstruct the past if I think it hard enough.
My favorite little cliche saying for last year was that I learned was, forgiveness is giving up all hope for a better past.
Actually, I have a question to you. Do they come true sometimes?
To me?
Yeah.
No, I can't reconstruct the past, unfortunately. Mostly it has to do with reconstructing the past.
Yes.
I had an image come up, and I panicked because I wasn't really sure what to do with the image, which was some snow and a bird in the snow. And I didn't know whether to go towards that to sort of enjoy that and then go back to the breathing, or to go, oh, no, I'm not supposed to be doing that, and then
okay.
Go back to the breathing.
Okay. Well, maybe now is when I can switch and talk a little bit more about the instructions. So the basic idea, again, to repeat, just ad nauseum maybe, the basic practice is to stay with the breath and kind of give some preference, some priority to being with the breathing. So there's a kind of oomph, a kind of directionality to the attention to be with the breath. Develop some concentration and presence there. But as soon as something else becomes compelling, as soon as something else comes through the door into your little house, then you can just let go of the breath and pay attention to whatever else arises. So that can be anything in the body, it can be anything in our emotional world. And paying attention to it doesn't mean thinking about it. It doesn't mean, you know, analyzing it. It means simply to feel it. The operating word here is feeling it, sensing it fully as an experience in the moment, as it is, to allow it to be there as it is. Sometimes thoughts become compelling. Some people think in words. Some people will think more in images. But we call them, both we call kind of thoughts for the time being. Different kind of minds. When these kinds of things occur, and it's they're often. I mean, often that's the reason why we kind of lose the present moment, is we get lost in our thoughts. What we want to do is, if it's relatively mild, the thinking, just a very simple acknowledgement, kind of automatic acknowledgement. Oh, I'm lost. I'm thinking. Is enough for you to come back to your breath and stay with the breath. There's not much of a pull. You're not attracted to the thoughts so much. You're not compelled by them so much. So you just come back and just be with your breathing. Sometimes, however, the thoughts are more compelling, or we're more involved with the thoughts. So there's kind of they're more active and involved, and it's not so easy to come back to the breath because they're kind of going along quite strong. Your thoughts. When that's the case, then it isn't that's bad. You have to stop thinking necessarily. What we're trying to do is to be awake, to be mindful of the fact that we're thinking. And so all we need to do is to turn the attention to the event of thinking and make the note to ourselves, thinking, thinking. You say to the little whisper in the mind, oh, thinking, thinking, thinking. To acknowledge fully this is what's going on. And then and sometimes, if the thoughts are kind of mildly compelling, to recognize them and to see them in this kind of detached way, unattached way or whatever, is enough to kind of sever our entanglement with the thinking. And if we're not entangled with our thoughts, they tend to kind of float away by themselves. There's a distinction that I make sometimes between thoughting and thinking. Thoughting is kind of what you guys described, you know, just things, because the thought mind just creates thoughts all the time, is what it does. It's our involvement often that creates associated thinking that builds on that and does things with it, and then one leads to another. We don't have to do anything with our thoughts at all. We can just allow them to come and go. So it's our involvement. So if we're more bringing attention, and if there's more attention than there is involvement, then our involvement dissipates and it tends to kind of float away by itself, at which point just come back to the breathing. It isn't that we're trying to get rid of our thoughts, but it's just what tends to happen if you bring full awareness to the fact that you're thinking, if you look the thought head on. It's important to say that in mindfulness practice, the content of your thoughts have no particular importance. You don't have to worry about the content. There's no wonderful, perfect thought you're going to have that's going to solve everything. You don't have to worry about your contents of your thought. It isn't that thinking is bad. Again, other situations in your life, thinking things out is very important. But it's a great relief, at least in the meditation practice, that you don't have to be concerned about the content. That's not what we're doing, is thinking. We're not thinking about things. So just kind of look the event of thinking straight on and be honest and say, I'm thinking, and then go back to the breathing. Sometimes thoughts are very compelling. We're just kind of driven by them, and there's no hope to going back to the breath, or you can go back to the breath for a fraction of a second, but then boom, you're back thinking about tomorrow and all the things you have to do and planning how you're going to get them done and everything. When thoughts are really compelling, very powerful, and we're driven by them, then it's very useful to feel what it's like energetically in your body to have that kind of thoughts. All thoughts can be experienced energetically or physically in the body, but most of the time it's too subtle for us, and our mindfulness is not sharp enough to really see that. But when the thinking is really sharp and strong and compelling, you can feel sometimes the energetics or the physicality of the thinking event. So, for example, sometimes when we think really hard, we make a furrow here in our forehead, right? That's an example of how our thinking manifests itself in our body. And you can feel sometimes a tightness or pressure in the forehead, or a pressure or tightness inside the skull or around the whole band here, or in the jaws or in the throat or in the shoulders, or different places with different people at different times, that it energetically manifests itself, or it feels like 10,000 bumblebees, rushing around all different directions in your head, or energetically you feel all kinds of things when things are, you're really compelled. There's a lot of energy in thinking. So just to feel, so acknowledge your thinking, and then to feel it energetically. You don't have to be concerned about the content, but just feel what it's like energetically in the body, and hang out with it. Just note tension, energy, and just feel it, making lots of space for it to be as it is, just feeling it. And as you feel it physically, then you're less involved with the content, and whatever will happen will happen. Sometimes when thoughts are extremely compelling and they continue, or maybe they're not too compelling exactly, but they keep reoccurring. The same kind of thing happens over and over and over again. You're always planning. It's easy to come back to your breath. You can stay with the breath for a little while. Then you find yourself planning again, or whatever, or remembering, or fantasizing. Sometimes being a little bit more accurate about the label, not just simply labeling it thinking, but labeling it accurately, planning, remembering, helps soften our involvement with it, our preoccupation. But also, if you notice that we're repeatedly thinking things over and over again, or it's very powerful, investigating what the emotional source of that thinking can be very useful. If you're constantly thinking the same thing, constantly planning, there's almost certainly some kind of emotional factory, some kind of emotion that's there. It might be somewhat subtle. That's the reason that you keep thinking the same thing, or kind of the source of what fuels the whole process. People who spend a lot of time planning, not always, but it's oftentimes a lot of time planning in their meditation, will discover, if they look under the surface, they'll find there's anxiety or fear, apprehension. And it's the anxiety, the fear, which is fueling all the constant planning. Sometimes it can be excitement or interest, which is fueling the planning. Or, it could be various kinds of things. But there's some kind of emotional mood or emotion that's there. Or if you're constantly reviewing the past, maybe it's a sense of hurt, which is the underlying emotion or feeling. So then the instructions is simply to feel the genesis of it, feel the underlying factory as fully and as non-judgmentally and as non-analytically as you can. Just simply feel the fear. And that, what I talked about last week then is very important, to feel the fear in your body. Note, label it as fear, fear. See it head on, be honest about it. Feel it in the body. And notice what happens to it as you're aware of it. Notice what your relationship is to it. Are you afraid of your fear or whatever? So the idea is, we try to be as mindful as we can of whatever it is that's kind of wanting our attention. And if thinking is really compelling, that's kind of where our attention should go. But we don't want to go involved in the content. We simply want to see the event as it is. And if it's very strong or very repetitive, it can be very useful to feel the other aspects of that thinking phenomena aside from its content, the energetics in the body or the emotional component part of it. And then just hang out there. Nothing has to happen except we're awake for the event. And a lot of these instructions are really about how to be awake in the midst of it. It's a lot easier to be awake in the midst of it, of a thinking storm, if you know all these different parts of it. If you think that the only thing going on is the content, it's a lot easier to get caught in it. Make sense? Is it too complicated, all this? Maybe a little bit. So what are your thoughts or your questions? Yes?
Speak a little more about those people who are more visually oriented.
Oh, good, thank you. In that case, rather than making label thinking, as you kind of recognize and acknowledge it, you just note it as seeing. That's all. And there's no need to kind of go towards it. There's no need to get involved in the seeing or enjoying it. There's no need to avoid it. You just want to stay kind of open and clear in the midst of it. Just notice seeing.
What if your natural
Well, that's interesting. So, if what you're seeing is the most compelling phenomena of it, just stay with seeing. You know, if the emotion's in the background, you don't have to worry about it. Just leave the emotions in the background.
But it could be a multimedia.
Yeah, you can kind of be creative in what you want to explore. You can just I'll explore different parts of it. Yeah, I mean, if it's a multimedia, it's not clear which is the most compelling. But you can just kind of go wherever you want, you know, with it within those that phenomena. But if the emotions are in the background and not so particularly compelling, you don't have to go there particularly, unless the seeing is very compelling, it's happening over and over and over again. Then you might actually go to something which is not so compelling, but might be the fuel for it. So it might be the emotion. But normally we just wait until the emotion becomes strong. And when the emotion becomes strong, then just go to the emotion. The basic instructions is we bring our attention to whatever is predominant in our experience. And if we're not sure, just go back to your breath. The breath is a default. Yes, in the back. Yes.
I wanted to have you just follow up a little bit more on the imagery. Often I find that I use imagery as a strategy in my meditation to get me as a means to an end, as a means of quieting my mind down. And I'm not sure so much whether it's an image or a metaphor, and whether these... So, for example, I imagine a mind above a mind as a way of watching my mind. And sometimes that's a very concrete image I hold of a brain above a brain, as it were. That it sometimes floats out, floats in, and I find that very effective for me. So my question is this something that maybe I don't want to pursue as a strategy, this kind of metaphor of a mind above a mind, if it's manifested as kind of image?
I think it's very wise for you to call it a strategy. And if you find it useful, if the consequence or the results of that kind of activity is useful for you in your life, if it makes you calmer, more subtle, or more concentrated, or something, and that's what you want, there's nothing wrong with that particularly. However, that's not mindfulness practice. Mindfulness practice is not using any kind of imagery or any kind of thought or metaphor in order to create a change. We're not trying to create a change when we do mindfulness. What we're trying to do is to be awake. What we're trying to do is to be present for what's actually here. And it's a very subtle, it can be very subtle, but or very gross sometimes. But if we use imagery, using an image or a metaphor or idea like that, lends itself more to calming and concentrated states, and which is very nice. But that's actually different than waking up to what the state you already have. And it's actually much more radical and much more liberating to wake up and be attentive in the moment to what's actually here and learn to be wise about that than it is to change what's here to something that you prefer. And now that doesn't sound so appealing maybe because you'd rather be calm, but the opportunity is that the more we can learn this ability to wake up fully to what's here, we'll find our peace. We'll develop the ability to find our peace with whatever arises. We don't have to get calm in order to find our peace. Does this make sense to you?
I see the point you're making, for sure. I'm just fine, but I still, with this metaphor, get to the point where I'm labeling those thoughts. I kind of see them, and I feel that's a planning thought, or I'm thinking about something. That was a thought about what I wanted to say. So I'm still mindful of what this lower mind is doing, not so much to calm it or dampen it out, but to kind of look down, as it were, in this metaphor and say, planning or discomfort or thinking, to do that kind of labeling.
Oh, I see.
I have this metaphor in mind. It's all very, just keeps working.
Can you do it without the metaphor being there?
I find the metaphor, I think I find that's often a...
Metaphor is kind of a description, right?
Yeah.
So maybe you don't need a description. Drop the description and keep doing what you're doing. Yes?
I kind of have a question, I think, for the group. I spent several years living in Europe, and then I recently left a position where I was primarily speaking foreign language every day for the last year and a half. So I've been speaking foreign language for a long time, and I'm coming back. I'm now in a place where I'm only speaking English, and I feel like I've been through a phase of having problems with the way I learn to perceive currents of thought and feeling in one cultural paradigm, in one setting in my mind, the way I learn to think and see. I'm having to rearrange it and change it to think in this other one, which is more monodimensional, and it's a tough transition, and I don't know if anybody else has gone through this, but I'm finding that the root of where I see clearly, the root of my clarity, and the root of my centeredness, it's like it's shifted to a different place in me.
Beautiful. I think I've gone through that. I mean, I speak different languages and have appreciated how my mind, who I am almost, and how I think and how I see the world and is different depending on the language I speak. And it's very powerful. It's actually one of the great ways to have an insight that meditators will only have when their concentration is very deep. And that is how deep our conditioning is. And how constructed, how much of our life is constructed by culturally conditioned phenomena, ideas and languages and stuff. And it's not that one culture is better than the other necessarily, but it's just different cultures have different conditioning. And if you learn another language and the culture at the same time, you learn a whole different set of conditionings. And by speaking two languages, you can see, it's just conditioned phenomena. It's not the nature of the universe for us to be this way. It's just the way it's been constructed. So it shows you how much is arbitrary that people only speak one language, only know one culture, think is absolute.
But I guess what I'm asking is it normal to feel like all of a sudden it's almost like you lose your footing and you have to find your new center? And I don't know how to explain it to anybody unless you're speaking a couple of different languages, but you change. It's like a different person in you comes out again, and you have to adjust to living with that person and that identity, and therefore your center. Am I making sense?
Yeah, it makes sense to me.
I also speak three languages. Sometimes I sit here and I think in a different language.
Yeah.
And it brings a different period in my life and a different feeling.
Yeah.
Sometimes I even do it on purpose in writing.
You think so?
Yes, and it's very natural and it's actually very interesting and enriching. early childhood, and I spoke another language, and then, you know, it's really just sometimes when I want to be connected to my mother or to my early childhood, then I think in imagine Russian. So Russian.
No one else in my family speaks a foreign language, so I can't explain it to anyone.
Yeah, okay. It's very natural. I didn't think it could be the language. It's very hard to emotion and take it in one's life, and I think that many people here experience the same feeling, because like, many people here speak a few languages and went through different cultures.
So get back to maybe we try sitting in a few minutes, but you should remember that one of the beautiful things about mindfulness, it is one of the options. It's what we always have the option, the opportunity, to bring mindfulness and attention to a situation, rather than reactivity or, you know, all the different ways we might respond to a situation. Just this is what's going on, or this is what I'm feeling. It makes for much more energy and aliveness when even, you know, when we can bring attention, because attention is not culturally bound. It's not part of, you know, not so much as part of this same kind of cultural conditioning. And so it's wonderful. You can always bring, transcends culture. Oh, attention. Last one, and then we'll...
feeling of dread. And then I thought, what on earth is that? That's like my favorite thing to see, is that right moment right before it happens. And I started thinking about it, and I realized that I've talked about repetitive thoughts. I've been worrying about dormant spring and peach trees for so long because of the rain that I was watching really carefully to see if I'd run out of time. The thing that made me unhappy was I did. I dormant sprayed them that weekend, but I had that thought so many times that it was a knee-jerk negative reaction to seeing those
The mind is phenomenal. One of the things that will happen as you become more mindful of your mind is you'll stand in awe of it. So let's end with some sitting. So if you want to jump directly into mindfulness, you'd simply notice what's happening for you right now. Whatever is predominant. Allowing it to be as it is, without being caught up in it. Or if you're caught up in it, then noticing the caught upness. And then at some point, centering yourself on your breathing, feeling the breath come and go. Mindfulness of breathing is one of the great spiritual practices. Very few other things connect us to our depth as does paying attention to our breathing in a matter-of-fact, simple way. when sounds are predominant, then it's listening meditation. When body sensations are predominant, then it's body sensation, body meditation. When emotions are predominant, it's emotion meditation. Receiving our life as it is into our awareness, and then getting to know it better, investigating it, feeling it in the body. Thank you. I have a couple of announcements. One is that this Saturday in this room here at 9 o'clock we have kind of half day retreat with yoga and meditation. A yoga teacher is in our meditation group is teaching with me, and 9 to 12:30, and a lot of sitting and some yoga for some 3.5 hours. The other thing is I brought with me a whole bunch of copies of this book called Voices from Spirit Rock. It's a book that I helped edit, and it's an anthology of talks by the 12 teachers who are teaching at Spirit Rock, the meditation center we're affiliated with. And it's a wonderful way of kind of getting a sense of the teachings in the sense of the personalities a little bit of these 12 teachers. I'm one of the 12, so there's a talk in here by me, by a talk on fear. And there's a little kind of description of each teacher. And then I thought the reason I brought it was that the introduction, I wrote kind of very simply the basic instructions for mindfulness practice. And I've been too complicated here. Maybe reading it is better. Corrects me. This will correct any mistakes I've made. So anyway, it's out there, and if you want to buy it. The beautiful thing about buying this book is that your entire proceeds go to as a donation to the meditation hall we're building at Spirit Rock in Marin County. The entire book was produced as a result of many people's generosity, including it was self-published in a sense, and the publisher, and someone donated the cost for printing it and everything. So we never distributed anywhere except, but it's an act of generosity, the production of it, and your buying it also is an act of generosity because it goes help us build a meditation center. So thank you, and I hope that you can sit in your easy chair.